In a moment, another in the series of lectures by Bertrand Russell on living in the atomic age. The program The Great Fraud has returned to ABC. It's a timely series of reports by Mrs. Ida Siegel, authority on USSR and its people. Mrs. Siegel reveals false items printed in Pravda and Izvestia, the two principal organs of the Soviet press, explaining the purpose of the Soviet government in misinforming its people. She reports USSR developments in domestic and international policies since the death of Premier Stalin, includes a forecast of future trends under the Malenkov regime. For a clearer understanding of Russia's policies, don't miss The Great Fraud tonight on ABC. Ladies and gentlemen, in cooperation with the British Broadcasting Corporation, the Public Affairs Department of the American Broadcasting Company presents transcribed the fifth in a series of six lectures entitled Living in an Atomic Age by the distinguished English philosopher, mathematician, sociologist, and author, Bertrand Russell. The subject of the fifth lecture is Conflict and Unification. Here is Lord Russell.
The science of economics has been wrapped around by the theorists in a series of many veils, which have caused the plain man to suppose that there must be something indecent about its naked form. I think the only thing to do in this predicament is to begin again at the beginning with matters of such simplicity that you may be indignant at hearing them mentioned. Economics in the past laid more stress upon competition than upon anything else. Competition, in the sense in which it was used in classical economics, depends upon the existence of commerce regulated by law. It has, in theory, nothing to do with that more primitive competition, which has become the function of armies and which decides the ownership of land. It exists, in theory, only within a fixed framework of law. Given a number of men who all independently produce a certain commodity and expect to live by exchanging it for other commodities, they will obviously all try to get as much of other commodities in exchange as they can. But each will be limited in his demands by the fact that his competitor may ask less. This limitation only arises when the producers of the commodity in question between them can produce more of the commodity that can be sold at a profit, or at any rate without loss. The whole system only works where there are law courts and policemen to enforce contracts. And as soon as the stage of primitive barter has been surpassed, there must also be a more or less stable currency, which is legal tender. There are all kinds of elaborate legal restrictions of methods of competition. You must not assassinate your leading competitor. This form of competition is the prerogative of the state. You are allowed to tell the public how good your product is, but you must not tell them how bad the other man's is. All sorts of wonderful things were thought to result from free competition. It was thought that at a given price, the better commodity would get the larger sales, and it was thought that any improvement in methods of production would enable the man who made the improvement to undersell his competitors. Thus, competition would result in improving quality and cheapening methods of production. There may possibly have been some small element of truth in this theory 150 years ago in the cotton trade. Certainly the production of wage earners was cheaper than to the utmost, and so was the production of raw cotton by means of plantation slavery. The system worked admirably because of the cotton operatives and the plantation slaves, but they did not write the economic textbooks. But gradually things ceased to work out as the classical economist posed, though it was a long time before economists noticed this. Competition within a country belongs to an early stage in industrial development. In all the more important industries, the tendency towards virtual monopoly is irresistible, and then there comes a moment when either the industries take over the state or the state takes over the industries. The former course is favored by those nostalgic devotees of the past who imagine that they are thereby serving the god of free competition. But the other course is the one which is increasingly being adopted in practice, even where in theory it is being avoided. Consequently, competition in the modern world is between nations, not between individual producers. The British, for instance, wish to sell motor cars in America. This is a governmental matter to be decided between Whitehall and Washington. Whitehall has to decide how much in the way of raw materials can be allocated to the manufacture of motor cars. And Washington has to consider how much irritation in Detroit is less harmful to the United States than the bankruptcy of the British government. If the British were too successful in the export of their cars, the American government would raise the tariff. If they were too unsuccessful, it might conceivably suggest lowering the tariff. Modern industrial technique has made competition far less important than it used to be, and has made different industries and different parts of the world far more interdependent than they formerly were. The emphasis upon competition has led many people to suppose that whatever is disadvantageous to A must be advantageous to B. This comes of thinking that competition is a more fundamental and more frequent economic relation than cooperation. But such a view is completely out of date, and where it persists, it is very harmful. Economic cooperation has two main forms. One is exchange, and the other is the fitting together of different stages in the production of one commodity. As for the first, it should be fairly easy to understand that if you ruin your customer, he will not buy as much from you as he did when he was prosperous. The other modern form of cooperation, namely that between different stages in the production of a given commodity, is more interesting and more complex in its workings. Modern industrial technique requires a great deal of very expensive fixed capital, which is only capable of certain uses. If the finished product which it is intended for is no longer in demand, this fixed capital becomes useless, and all the labor that has gone into producing it does nothing to increase the amount of consumable commodities. Modern methods of mass production require an immense amount of labor before they yield any return whatever in the way of finished products. But when they begin to yield a return, the return is very large. In the meantime, circumstances may have changed so that the product is no longer required. And in that case, the elaborate work of preparation is wasted. Consider the sort of thing that happened at the beginning of the Great Depression. Everybody had felt rich and had expected to be able to buy all sorts of expensive things. Preparations were made for producing all these expensive things. And then it turned out that the preparations had been excessive. The men who had made preparations for one sort of commodity could not sell their products, and therefore could not buy another sort of commodity. And so the makers of that other sort of commodity could not buy yet a third sort, and so the depression spread. Vast amounts of preparation for the production of commodities suddenly became useless. The men who should have been at work were unemployed, and in their turn could spend much less than had been expected. And so what had been expected to be the means of producing wealth became suddenly useless, and everybody was poor. In such a situation, everybody's apparent private interest is diametrically opposed to the public interest. The banks, which have lent money, are afraid that their debtors will go bankrupt, and therefore call in loans, right and left, thereby causing the bankruptcy that they fear. Dread of disaster makes everybody act in the very way that increases the disaster. Psychologically, the situation is analogous to that of people trampled to death when there is a panic in a theater caused by the cry of fire. In the situation that existed in the Great Depression, things could only be set right by causing the idle plant to work again. But everybody felt that to do so was to risk almost certain loss. Within the framework of classical economics, there was no solution. Roosevelt saved the situation by bold and heretical action. He spent billions of public money and created a huge public debt. But by so doing, he revived production and brought his country out of the Depression. The principle which Roosevelt applied in the New Deal is the same principle which is now needed in international affairs. Although it seems paradoxical, it is nevertheless the fact that the way to avoid poverty is to spend. This, of course, does not apply to private individuals who cannot spend more than they have, but it does apply to governments which alone have the privilege of not paying their debts. Americans have a great desire to sell their goods abroad, but they cannot do so unless foreign nations can afford to buy. I do not wish to say anything that may sound ungenerous about martial aid, but I shall only be repeating what its American advocates have urged when I say that it serves the interests of America as well as those of Europe. I do not mean only what is undoubtedly true, that it has halted the spread of communism in Western Europe. I mean that actually America is better off financially owing to spending money on reviving Europe. I have spoken of the wastefulness of industrial plant lying idle, but the enforced idleness of human beings is even worse. Idle plant and idle human beings are alike useless, but the idle human beings also suffer. The older economic theory was quite unable to deal with the problem of unemployment. We now know, however, that they can be controlled. We owe this knowledge chiefly to Keynes. The broad principle is that governments must spend and encourage spending when private people feel inclined to save, and must encourage saving or compel it by means of taxation when private people feel inclined to spend. There is a general conclusion to be drawn from modern economic development, and that is that any nation which desires to prosper must seek rather cooperation than competition with other nations. The world is economically unified in a way in which it never was at any earlier period. And even in terms of hard cash, it is seldom profitable nowadays for one nation to ruin another. Nay, more, if another nation is ruined, it is almost always profitable for a nation which can afford it to help the ruined nation on the road to recovery. This is because, broadly speaking, nations are more important to each other as customers than as competitors, and also because unemployment is a waste of which the disadvantages are felt not only in the nation in which the unemployment exists, but in varying degrees throughout the world. Although Congress finds this a little hard to understand, many people in international organizations now realize this. A start in the direction of world economic cooperation, of a world where economic cooperation replaces competition, has already been made not only in the Marshall Plan and the Organization for European Economic Cooperation, but also in the Colombo Plan. This doctrine, which is promulgated by hard-headed economists for hard-headed reasons, encounters obstacles that are psychologically derived from the fetish of competition, and inherited with far too little change from our savage ancestors who knocked each other on the head with clubs. If the modern economic system is to work, we have to learn a less pugnacious and more cooperative outlook than that which tradition has made familiar.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have just heard the fifth in a series of six lectures by Bertrand Russell, entitled Living in an Atomic Age. We invite you to listen next week, when the last lecture will be presented by Lord Russell. The subject has been a transcribed feature of the Public Affairs Department of ABC in cooperation with the British Broadcasting Corporation. The program came to you from New York. This is ABC Radio Network.